Today I had lunch at Nan Pang Sandwiches. I had a Japanese yam sandwich.
I actually went there for lunch today too. Null check, check, inject, define, APK, life cycle and design. Null check, check, inject, define, APK, life cycle and design. Null check, check, inject, define, APK, life cycle and design. Null check, check. Inject and bind, APK, life cycle and design, it's time.
From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
In today's episode, Don talks to friend of the show, Michael Bailey. Since both Don and Michael are aficionados of testing, they actually took some time off to sit down and come up with 10 clear and useful tips so all of us can up our testing game. Listen on as they talk about unit tests, espresso tests, mocking, hermetic testing, automated testing. Seriously, folks, this episode is chock full of great content for those inclined to do more testing, and you should be one of those people. I couldn't make it for this episode, but I loved listening to it, and I'm sure you will too. Take it away, Don.
Okay, so today I am here in New York City visiting, and I am here with Michael Bailey. Kaushik's not here today, unfortunately, so Michael's going to take this other end of the table here with me, and we're going to discuss some testing tips here that we've encountered. But before we kind of get into all that kind of stuff, Michael, for those of you that didn't hear you early on in the Fragmented history, would you mind telling folks who you are and maybe your background and so forth?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So my name is Michael Bailey. I am a principal engineer focused on mobile and more specifically Android at American Express. I've been doing Android since about 2010. And that's, you know, that's what I love. I do some speaking engagements. You can probably find some of my videos on YouTube of things I've talked about in the past. And one of the things I've talked about in the past is testing. So this will be great. And oh, one other thing is I have a personal podcast with a few of my friends called Native Wheelhouse. So if you're interested in that, just look it up on your normal podcast channels. It's called Native Wheelhouse.
Don't you guys have a unique URL for that too?
I think it's nativewheel.house.
Yes. So, you know, I didn't even know .house was a TLD until I saw that. I was like, oh, okay, interesting.
Well, that was when we were choosing the name of the podcast. We wanted something that was Googleable so that when you Googled it, it wouldn't come up with too many other things that people could actually find us, and we could get a domain that matched. So
that's cool. Right on. Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on the show, as you said, you discussed testing a lot, and it's something that I'm very passionate about, and we've kind of agreed on many years that just testing in general is something that a lot of folks should do, mainly if it's TDD, if it's whatever, but just making sure you have a huge set of tests behind your application. Any new code you write should have new tests as well. But one of the big things that we get asked a lot here on Fragmented is, hey, Don, hey, Kaushik, how do I get going in testing? Should I write espresso tests first? Should I be writing JUnit tests first? What's the difference? Do I need to use things like some cloud testing tools? What about my API data? So all these things are problems that you and I have both solved at different times. And I think it would be great to just kind of sit down and chat about a couple of these things.
Yeah, so espresso, I would say the answer to espresso or JUnit is both. You know, why not both? So espresso is a tool from Google. It's part of the Android testing support library. Espresso is one of the things with that library, and espresso has a couple different components that come with it. The base of espresso is a tool that allows you to interact with the UI on the device. So Espresso operates inside of what's called an instrumentation test on Android. An instrumentation test is a test that has to run in a real Android environment. It could be an emulator, it could be a virtual device on some cloud out there, or it could be a physical device that you're attached to. So that's what an instrumentation test has to run in a real Android environment. And Espresso has to run on instrumentation tests.
Yeah. Now, for me, when folks normally ask me, Don, I want to start writing tests. I don't have any tests. I usually advise them the first thing to go do is go write an Espresso test. And that's just mainly because it's part of the platform. It's easy to do, or somewhat easy to do. We're going to talk about some of the problems here in a minute. But you can go look at the documentation fairly easily. And it's kind of widely supported by Google. Is that something that you usually advise folks do, or no? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I would say start with one test. I mean, it kind of sounds obvious, but you don't have to say, I'm going to test all my app and, you know, get overwhelmed and then not do it at all. Start with one test. And then once you see the value from that test, you'll probably want to add another and another. It's nice to get to a state where every change you make is accompanied by the relevant tests, but that can go down the road. I mean, if you can write one test to start, it's a great place to start. And Espresso's a good way to get into tests, because even if your code is not structured well for certain types of unit testing, with Espresso tests, essentially you are interacting with the app as a user would. So you're clicking a button, you're entering some tests. So pretty much every application can be tested and interacted with Espresso, assuming it has some sort of UI to interact with.
Now, I guess most people would call it a functional test, and that's usually what I call it. Is that something that you would agree with too?
Yeah, it's a functional test, and it depends a little bit of, you know, if it's an integration test end to end, it depends on kind of what ends you're talking about. You can write a test that tests purely one code base, maybe your Android code base, from network to UI, kind of from both ends of the code base. Or you could actually use Espresso to drive an application that then talks to a real server and goes all the way back to whatever layers you have on the back end, databases and applications and things like that. And that's kind of more of an end-to-end test, which those can be valuable, but they can also be flaky at times because you're testing things outside of your code base. So, you know, think about what the scope of the test is. Is it just this one code base from UI to network, or is it your entire application from mobile client all the way back to your systems of record that contain your data?
It makes sense. And I should prefix this by saying everything we just talked about is actually like one of the first tips here is use Espresso testing for your test framework. If you're getting into it, if you're learning about testing, use Espresso. That's kind of our number one. And this kind of leads us into number two. If you want to lead us off into number two here, what's important?
Yeah. So when you're doing Espresso testing, I recommend that if you just want to test from one end of your data or your application to the other, use Espresso to automate the front end, but then use a tool that mocks your data at the back end so that during your Espresso test, it's not going off to real servers, which adds additional failure points to your tests. And sometimes this is called hermetic testing. Yep. Kind of you're sealing it off from the outside world so that you have full control of everything that goes on your test. And that makes your test way more repeatable. I recommend that you not actually contact your real backend for most of your tests.
Now, this is probably the biggest problem that most folks end up encountering, and it was for me for a very long time. And actually, when we first met back in 2010, 2011, you were already doing hermetic testing and by using a tool called WireMock. And just recently, I started using Mock Web Server for some other projects. And those are both tools that allow you to mock out the responses from a server, provide different, JSON responses, XML responses, or whatever, but it just kind of runs as a local server in your local application test environment. Which one do you end up using? Are you still using WireMock, or is WireMock a still supported thing, or do you use Mock Web Server? Which direction do you go?
Yeah, I definitely have most experience with WireMock, although there's some, there are other great open source solutions out there. It depends. So if you're using Retrofit for your networking layer, Retrofit has its own mock data layer. So you can use Retrofit mocks and mock at the Retrofit layer. If you mock at the Retrofit layer, though, you're not actually doing the HTTP level traffic. So there is a bit of your code base that's not getting fully tested if you mock at the Retrofit level. If you actually want to mock all, in test all the way down to the HTTP level where it's going across a socket, you can use something like WireMock, which runs, it can run on an outside server, but it's also possible to run WireMock on the device inside your instrumentation test so that none of the traffic leaves the device, and that makes it more hermetic. There are some alternatives to WireMock, like you mentioned, Mock Web Server. I would say Mock Web Server, which is part of HTTP, is much lighter weight. It has less features, but it's a trade-off, whereas WireMock definitely has more features. You can record things and play them back, and it has request matching. So I would say WireMock has a whole list of features that can be stateful so that when you send a request like, you know, update this record, then the next time you query, it can kind of impersonate that it's been updated and go to the next kind of mapping, and it's stateful, so that it can return a thing that now this is updated. So you can have a little bit of state in your server, which can be useful under certain circumstances. But there is a bit of weight to WireMock. It includes Jetty inside of it. And while Jetty is lightweight, in the context of testings, I would say Jetty is heavyweight. So it's all depending. If you're considering Jetty compared to some other full-blown container like JBoss, Jetty is lighter weight than JBoss. But if you're considering Jetty compared to what you usually have in your test, Jetty is kind of heavyweight to have as part of your automated test, whereas Mock Web Server is a much lighter weight and simpler dependency. So I would say maybe start with Mock Web Server, and if you need, you know, but look at what WireMock offers. And if something like WireMock is what you need, then maybe you can upgrade to a heavier dependency. But it's always nice to start with a lighter weight dependency like Mock Web Server.
Now, early on when we first met, I think WireMock wasn't supported on Android, and you kind of had to do some internal hacks. Do you know if it's now supported on Android or what?
Yeah, so version 1.0 had some dependency conflicts and some other complications to get that running within your actual Android app. WireMock 2, I think there's been some work done, and I'm pretty sure it's supported. Now, there's a Sam Edwards, you know, his handle is Hands to Hand Sam. He's done some work to make the new versions of WireMock work on Android. So I think you should be able to use that right out of the box as well.
All right. So that kind of wraps up number two, using and extracting, you know, using a different type of endpoint inside of your application, be it with, you know, Mock Web Server or WireMock. So basically mocking out that endpoint so you have that hermetic testing environment. Let's talk about number three, which is unit tests. And a lot of folks kind of get this confused of like, all right, well, I have Espresso and I'm using JUnit. Well, isn't that a unit test or is that not a unit test? How, if you were to explain to someone what the difference between a unit test is and maybe an Espresso test is, what would you tell them?
It's the scope of what you're testing. So with Espresso test, you're testing at the UI layer where you've got Android views involved. If you're end-to-end testing, you've got all the way down to your networking stack involved. So the scope of things that are under test is very big with a test like that. There's tons of code that's being exercised, which has its pluses and minuses. The advantages is that you're testing lots of code all at once. The downside is if your test fails, it could be anywhere from your UI code to some, you know, middle layer you have, all the way down to your networking code, your parsing code. So the value that you get out of a failed test is, well, it's great, I broke something, and so now I know how to fix it, but you can spend a lot of time figuring out actually where in your whole chain of things it broke. With a unit test, you're testing a much smaller scope of things. You're testing usually one class at a time, sometimes one method at a time, and you generally provide test doubles for the rest of the things, whether it be fakes or mocks or stubs, for the rest of the things outside of the code that's under test.
So what exactly, if we just for folks around, what is a test double?
So a test double is a way to, let's say I want to test my class foo, but foo has interactions and collaborates with other objects and things within my code base. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to test those things as part of my unit tests. So I use a test double to stand in for those collaborating classes. And depending on what you want to do. If you want to verify interactions, you might want to use a mock where you can verify that something was called on an external collaborator with that object. If you need something that acts more like the actual implementation but gives you additional levers to control the behavior of that dependency, you can use something like a fake. And some of these terms get used in different contexts. I don't know that there's a real standardization between a mock and a stub and a fake, depending on where you read. But the idea is that these are all forms of test doubles. So you're testing one thing, and all the things that it interacts with, you're putting in something that stands in for the real thing. So that, and that allows you to limit the scope of your test to that one class. And given that your scope is limited, if that test fails, you know, oh, I broke something in that unit, whether that unit be a class or a method. So it's much easier to track down what broke when you get a test failure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think a good video I saw on this was by Matt Logan. He had I think he presented it at the Denver GDG or something like that. And he had I think it was mock spies fakes or something like that. The title was, we'll link it in the show notes, but it was a good talk discussing all of those different options and kind of how they fit in or when to use each one or when not to use each one. So I'll link that in the show notes. So unit tests, when I first started doing them, they made sense to me because that's how I've done testing for a long time was unit tests. And the cool thing about unit tests to me was that they were just fast because they're running the JVM. I don't have to fire up Android. So literally if I have 1,000 JVM or JUnit JVM based tests, I mean, they will run in a second, couple of seconds, really super fast once it gets cranking. But the problem is I'm an Android and I, for some reason, always need an intent or I need a string or I need something that's inside of my code. And so what I've always found is like, I always have to basically pull out some logic, put it into some class, and I can test that independently. And then I feel like I have this class explosion problem and there's no method to the madness. But as I've seen lately, there's kind of the resurgence of UI patterns in Android. And it seems like MVP has been one of those that helps with testing just because you can break apart the view and the model and the presenter and you put your business logic in your presenter. To me, that's a big bonus because you can now put all that logic in the presenter and you can put all of your tests in JVM unit tests and they'll execute quickly. Is this something that you recommend doing or do you do anything different or what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that if you want to unit test something, you have to have some sort of UI architecture, and whether it be MVP or MVVM or one of those, it's good to have a UI architecture. And really, I always say the most important thing is like be consistent. It's like pick one and try to stick with it so that it makes your code base easier to understand. I would say if you have two great UI architectures in different parts of the code, I'd rather have one good one that's used everywhere. But yeah, that allows you to break out your interactions with the view system. In this case, the thing that the user is interacting with, but in these patterns, most of the time you can, use test doubles if you're using something like MVP, and you don't actually have to depend on classes like the Android view class and the actual Android touch handling and all of this stuff, which can really complicate your testing and make it slower. And, you know, abstracting this out allows you to run these tests outside of an Android context and just purely on a JVM that runs on your local development machine or on your CI server. And you can get rid of the whole complication of having to have an Android environment to run your tests.
Exactly. Which I think kind of brings us to number four.
So number four, I would say, is use pull requests or something like that when you're doing your code. And the idea of a pull request, and that's kind of a term that's somewhat specific to Git, but the idea is that you develop on a branch and then you submit your changes on that branch and say, I would like to merge these changes onto this other branch.
Wait, so I shouldn't develop everything on developer master?
Yeah, maybe that's, you know, not the best best way to go. Just merge it and call it YOLO, right?
But no. Dash F, right? Force push.
Force push. No, you know. Because you want to give your teammates a chance to review, and I get a lot of great, one, they find mistakes in my code. And they, you know, I learn a lot from my my colleagues about, you know, hey, maybe you could do it this way or you could do it that way. So pull requests allow code review, and code review is good because it catches defects, but also spreads learning about how the code base works among your team members. So a team member who hasn't worked on this part of the code base or this new feature that I'm working on, now they have some understanding of what I'm working on because they looked at my code as part of a code review. So using this method where I go off and I develop on a branch and then I submit my proposed changes through a thing called a pull request. And then there's some checks that happen on that. And when we're confident that that pull request is ready, then it gets merged onto your branch that is destined for production.
And so I guess the big question here that I have is, all right, so I have someone who code reviews, and I actually saw an article floating around today of like proper rules for code reviews. What does that kind of code review look like? You said something like, hey, here's a mistake you've made. So let's say you've made a mistake or there's a better way to do something and you've implemented it. How do you know when it's good to proceed on to merge that branch in?
Yeah. So you want, I mean, there's a lot of different things you could do. I mean, one is you can get a thumbs up from a coworker, right? And so that's a good thing. Some people do more than one thumbs up. You know, you need two coworkers to approve. Some tools will actually let the reviewers open tasks so that they can say, you know, they can get, basically give you a to-do list of like, here's the five things that you need to check off before you, this thing is ready to move, merge. I always love that because especially, you know, things are busy and it's like, okay, this person said this on which changes. So it's great to have that, that list of things that the reviewer gave me and I can just check them off one by one as I address those issues. Other things that you can do is integrate it with your CI, continuous integration, build server, whatever, where you are, and this kind of maybe takes us into our next tip, where your CI actually runs all your tests and then it reports back to your Git management pull request system and says, yep, this change passes all of the tests for the code base. And that, I mean, to me, that's huge because it really can catch a lot of issues and you catch them before it gets merged. So you catch these issues much earlier in your development cycle, which you're in the context of that pull request. You know, like, oh, I changed this code and it broke this thing over there. So it's a lot easier to figure out what you broke when you get that feedback very soon. You know, what are some things that you think should go on in PRs as well?
You've nailed a lot of them. The review is the big part. And there's some tools out there that I really like. They actually have a button that say, all right, that says approve. Like they can click a button, whoever this person is, and they can click approve you. This is going to be your colleague or whatever. But one thing I would like to bring up is A, just have someone peer review your code. Now, there's a lot of people out there in the startup community, and I've been in the situation where you're the sole developer on an application. You're the only person who knows Android. At this point, it's really hard to get someone to pull to do a code review. What I recommend at that point is either finding someone you know who's another developer that you can get sign off from your boss, whatever, that, you know, have them sign an NDA where they can look at the code or whatever to do some type of quality assurance check. Reach out to a consultant that will only do maybe code reviews. And I've actually done that. And I know a few other consultants that have done that too, or they'll kind of help transition teams. But you definitely want that code reviewed in there. But the big thing is, that I love, and we've harped on this earlier on Fragmented, and I'll link the episode that we harped on this on, is number five is use a CI server, and that's continuous integration, because that to me really makes a difference. And this is the first thing I set up when I go to a startup, a new company that doesn't have much infrastructure in place. They're usually, you know, developing right on top of master. There's no tests. You pull code down at the, you compile, it's broken. It's like the first thing I do is, okay, we're going to set up a CI server. It doesn't matter if it's Jenkins, if it's Travis, if it's CircleCI, whatever. Get something set up where it's number one, you're building the code. So at the end, I should have an artifact that's an APK for the release and an APK for the debug build and any other, you know, product flavors that you may have. And then that's step one for me. And then step two is making sure that all the tests pass. And you mentioned this before, because if those tests pass, that's the key thing for me, because then I know that any changes that I made are actually successful or unsuccessful. Now, the big thing too is with this is with a lot of, you know, popular tools like GitHub, Bitbucket, and probably a few other Git servers out there. I don't know if GitLab does it though, is you can integrate with these build environments like through some type of hooks. And it'll actually call back saying, hey, all right, we noticed that there was a new branch. We started building it. It's building. It'll kind of report back feedback. And then all of a sudden, if the tests fail or if the compilation fails or whatever, it'll say, hey, it's broken. And it will not let you merge that pull request until it's completed. To me, that is the biggest value add at the end of the day, because it literally blocks me from blocking other people. That's the big thing.
Yeah, no, that's, I think that that seems like a CI can really add a lot of value.
So I kind of real quickly covered CI. Is there anything that you do that helps you speed up some of your development and your testing when it comes to just testing in general?
Yeah, so what I've done in the past that I found valuable is when you have these tests, they're running on your CI, hopefully, as you talked about, but you want to be able to run them locally and in somewhat easy way so it's not too much of a pain. So I think setting up some way so it's easy to for all your developers to run each individual test locally. So if I see, oh, this test failed on CI, that I can issue a local command, whether it be through Android Studio or from the command line, that says run this one specific test. And it's nice to be able to run a specific test and not rebuild your APK, because sometimes you want to attach a debugger. You just want to see, you know, look at the logs and look at the logs again and just be able to run the test. And you don't want to, while you're trying to understand the failure, you don't necessarily need to rebuild because you haven't made any changes. So just being able to quickly rerun the test from the beginning and attach a debugger. Or if you attached a debugger to your test and you kind of missed the event that caused the test to fail and you want to reattach a debugger so you know it, the problem happened earlier in the cycle, being able to rerun your test without doing a build is convenient. So in the past, I've set up shell aliases with, you know, Z-shell or whatever, where you can just say, you know, some alias like AT for Android test or whatever you want to call it that says AT and then the name of the test and the maybe the path or the name of the method or however you want to set it up. And it runs that one method without building it. It kind of just assumes that it's already installed if it's an Android test or, you know, if it's a JUnit test, assume it's already been built and maybe just runs that test. And then you could check those aliases into your application so that all your developers can share with them. And then they can just, you know, source those files into their shell environment and everybody can share those same helpers.
What do you do if you're in the situation where you got many different product flavors and your build just generally takes a long time? Is there any way to help remedy that situation that you're aware of?
Yeah, so I talked about this when I was on the Android Dialogues YouTube channel. You can put in what might be called a fast build, for lack of a better word, where you pass in a parameter to your build and it just disables all the things that you don't normally need when you're in kind of an edit, debug, compile, test cycle.
How does that work? Is it inside of Gradle, or is it just a switch you're passing into the Gradle command, or what?
So I mean, there's lots of different ways you could do it. One way is you can pass a Gradle property into the project, and then you can read that Gradle property inside your build files, and you can basically say, if this thing is set, don't do this set of things, or don't add this set of variants and things like that. So you're basically, in that context, getting down to the minimal things that you need to build the app for your edit, test, compile type cycle. Moving on to our next tip. Are you aware of like tools or things that might help you when you're on CI? You have a lot of tests. How are you going to run all these tests? Do you have like Android devices hooked directly to your CI, or what are the other options that you're aware of for doing that sort of thing?
Yeah, good question. Just to rehash, so far, the last tip was, you know, creating some type of helpers, if it's shell helpers or whatever, to just help out your test environment so you can run particular, you know, just maybe your JUnit tests or just your Espresso tests or whatever. So that was number six. So number seven, the tip here is, you know, use some type of cloud testing environment. Now, before I hop really deep into that, I remember a funny story that there was a years ago, I shared something on Twitter or something like that. I shared this, hey, here's a cool device testing little thing. And I forgot what it was called. You might remember what it is because I think you bought one. And you can kind of stick your devices up on the stand. Mm. And you told me that you were using it. And I think after a while, you were like burning through so many tests that the devices got hot or something. Or what happened?
Oh, yeah. I forget. It was a device lab thing. And it had Velcro on the back of the devices. And yeah, at the time, I was running some automated tests on these devices, and I just had them up on the stand so I could see the UI as they're all automating and the device screens are turning on. But yeah, we were running tests so much through our CI process that the devices heated up, and the devices heated up melted the adhesive on the Velcro, and then the devices, I would come in the morning, and the devices have all fallen off of the stand and they're all flat on the desk. So yeah, I was like, man, we're running a lot of devices there. And yeah, that's, having devices like that has its problems.
Yeah, definitely. So if you don't want to have devices on your desk when you get to work in the morning, there's a couple of different options out there that you could use. Now, these are going to be ones that are up in the cloud. Some folks use these, and we'll start with Google's here, and that's Firebase Test Cloud Lab. And of course, this is recently a newly released service, so you have basically virtual devices up in the cloud you can go ahead and use and run your tests against. There's a couple other ones out there, such as the Genymotion Cloud. I am not too familiar with the Genymotion Cloud, but from what I hear, you can run this on your own AWS instance, and you can kind of fire up tests against those devices. Another one is also Xamarin Test Cloud, so you can actually use Xamarin's Test Cloud, connect to them. Again, this has an API you can go against. They have a bunch of test devices you can connect to, run, install your APKs on. Now, a lot of these same types of things will actually be able to provide you with the logs if something crashes. They'll provide you with a video, like an MP4. Mm-hmm. You can actually watch the screen, which I recently did on one of my own projects. I fired something up and a test just kind of hung. I wasn't sure. The screen got black. I pulled down Logcat, saw that the test was X, Y, and Z. It was because I had not fired off an observable, and it was just waiting for some observable to finally complete, and it never did. So these are great. And then one more that I've recently heard of, too, is Amazon Device Farm. Now, this is one I have not played with, but this kind of is, going further down the line here. So if we walk through the steps here of, how to get going with testing, we've talked about number one, Espresso, building those devices. Number two, making sure you're mocking that data from your API so you can use Espresso effectively. Number three, using the fast JUnit unit tests with perhaps some type of UI pattern such as MVP or MVVM. And then we've talked about using PRs for number four and using Git effectively. So you're branching, you're pushing PRs up, which kind of led us to number five. Make sure you're using CI. So it'll check those PRs, build them, run your tests, etc. And then also, if we want to speed some of those up or maybe only run particular different tests on different or multiple different tests at different times on different environments, we could use some different types of helpers or shell helpers. And that was number six. And then it kind of brings us to number seven in our path here, which was just cloud testing. So once you've got this far, you've had all these things in, you're running your cloud testing. We're really kind of at the tip top of our testing environment. And unfortunately, there's not many companies that I've seen have got this far. But those that are there are really kind of top notch in my opinion. So is there anything else that you could think of that folks might be able to do in the testing world that would help them that we haven't covered yet?
Yeah, there's a lot of, things that I would say are less popular, less taken advantage of, and they really take your testing to the next level. One of them is mutation testing, and I personally don't have.
I don't even know what that is.
yeah. I saw it online somewhere. I read about it, and I don't have a lot of experience with it, but it kind of intrigued me because from what I understand, the idea is that during your tests, it mutates your code. So if there's an if else, then it like changes like your if is else and maybe the nature of the binary or your, comparisons, your Boolean comparisons, so that it forces it down different paths. And then it compares that with which test failed. So if it's able to change an if to an else in your test and your test still passed, well, maybe you're missing a whole test case. So it's able to find defects that aren't in your test, you know, in your test coverage or things that you're, you know, dead code, maybe it's like nothing ever happens different if we change the nature of this to a, for a true to a false. So it's running tests while manipulating the internals of your code. And there's one, I think it's called PIT, maybe PIT is it one mutation testing framework. Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I don't know that I fully understand it, but it's one of those more advanced testing techniques. And I'm sure there's many more that are out there if you really want to take your testing and you have the time to get really advanced with it.
What do you, this is kind of just, we're kind of going freestyle here, but what do you think about code coverage in general? Because I've had folks that have come to me and said, well, code coverage is garbage. It's nonsense that, you know, TDD purists spread. And other folks find it very useful. What's your take on it, though?
I think it goes into like the whole, you know, any single thing that you measure, people try to optimize for that. So if it's one additional data point that you can look at, and maybe it's part of a whole set of data points, then maybe there's some value there. You got to, with anything, you have to trade off the value with the effort put into measuring that. So if you think you're getting a lot of value with measuring your code coverage, sometimes it can be a little bit difficult to set up the code coverage and monitor that. You know, and maybe you just monitor, say, hey, we're at 20% today, and maybe that's fine. And we just want to make sure that we never go below 20%, or we want to make sure that over time we're trending in the right direction. We're trending to 25% or 30%. It can probably be helpful in that case. I think the biggest thing is, what value are you getting out of your tests? If when your tests fail, it's always because so it's something to do with your test. Your application was performing fine, but your tests were failing. That test is not giving you value in that particular instance. Tests give you value when it's like, oh, the test failed and something was actually broken in the app. So you're actually fixing an app issue. If every time a test fails, you're only fixing the test and you don't change the application at all, mm-hmm. then it wasn't really pointing out a problem in your application. So I would say, think more about the value that you're getting out of every test rather than how much coverage you have. And how much coverage maybe is just kind of a nice thing to know how you're trending.
I think that's a difficult thing for a lot of folks to get right out of the gate, especially when they start developing tests. You find a lot of folks create really brittle tests. They test every little tiny thing, and you make one small change, it maybe just moves a button to the left a little bit. And for some reason, the padding's different. And it's, you know, test is broken. Now, of course, there's going to be some folks out there that say, well, that padding may be changed incorrectly and could be overlaying another button.
Yeah.
So it's, you have to, I think it's case by case basis, which is, you know, one of those things, but you bring up a very good point that it's all around the value that you get out of it. Because again, if it's not providing you any value, then what's the point of the test even being there for?
Yeah, because tests are not, it's not like there's zero cost to test. Developers have to write them. You have to run them somewhere. So you want to make sure that the value that you get out of your tests, which is hopefully a higher quality app and less bugs, is worth the effort that you're putting in. And if you're still getting a ton of bugs and your code coverage is high, then what does it matter if your code coverage is high if you're still getting a lot of bugs? Or if your code coverage is low and you're not getting very many bugs, you know, that's the ultimate goal, is less bugs, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say that measuring the output of the quality in some way, whether it's the number of bugs or customer feedback, that's a better measure than test coverage.
All right. So I think let's go ahead and recap here. All right. Number one, again, was make sure you're using Espresso tests.
Number two is mock your data and keep your tests hermetic.
Number three, make sure you're using unit tests effectively. And if you need to break apart dependencies, use a UI pattern like MVP, MVVM, get them into JVM unit tests so they're a lot faster.
Number four, don't just commit all your code directly to master. Put it on a branch and have some sort of quality check before, with a pull request before it gets merged.
Number five, allow something else to automate this for you, and that's going to be a continuous integration server. Run those tests on the continuous integration server and allow it to have a green build. So all the tests pass, everything compiles just fine before you can pull in that pull request.
Number six, make it easy for your developers to rerun a test locally without building, whether it be a shell alias or something else. Make it easy to run tests locally.
Number seven, if you can, use some type of cloud testing environment. Run your tests against different environments if you can. If it's API 19 and you want to test against API 22 or 25, but don't just run them against one API because there's always going to be some new device out there. And you want to be able to test them on many different types of devices as well. Small, large, tablet, et cetera.
And number eight, look into advanced things like mutation testing once you've really gotten those first seven down for extra bonus.
And then we kind of threw in number nine here unknowingly, but we decided to talk a little bit about code coverage. So just really know if your tests add value at the end of the day. If it's something that's not adding value, you're just spending your time fixing it just to fix it. You might want to think about if that test is useful or not. Make sure all those tests have value. So those are the tips that Michael and I have here for you to help improve your testing, maybe get your application under test. We hope these things here help out. Michael, do you have anything else to say before we get going?
One thing with that last thing you just said triggered something in my mind, and that is about the management of flaky tests.
Oh, yes. Good point.
So a flaky test is a test that with no code changes, sometimes it passes, sometimes it fails. I think flaky tests in my mind are worse. It's better, worse to just have no test than the flaky test. So my approach to flaky tests is either delete the test entirely if it's too much trouble, or, you know, comment it out for fixing later, or fix it right in your pull request, fix it right away. But don't let flaky tests linger. And the reason is that if some tests fail or pass with no code changes, developers will start to not trust the test. They're not sure that the test failure is an indication of something going wrong. They'll just say, oh, tests are flaky, I can ignore that. So it's better to not get into that mindset and just keep flaky tests out, either by fixing them or just deleting them altogether if they're not providing enough value that it makes it worth it to fix the test.
So let's just call that number 10, take care of your flaky tests. There we go. 10 tips on how to make sure your testing environment is top notch.
Awesome.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, thanks, Don. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be back.
If folks want to reach you on or get a hold of you, what's the best way that they can do that?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Yogurt Earl on Twitter. If you're interested in where I got that name, go back to episode 10 and listen. It's about an hour and a half into episode 10. I get a lot of questions on where that came from.
You definitely need to go back and listen to that. It's hilarious. It's great. Thanks again, Michael.
Thanks.
That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.